Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Matt Welch and Catherine Mangue Ward, as well as special guest, Reason's very own, Christian Britschke. Everybody say hi.
Howdy.
Hi.
Good morning.
Happy Monday to everyone who actually followed the Kendrick Lamar Drake beef, which is not me. So on today's episode, we're going to talk about executive dysfunction and the legal challenges facing Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Also, the RFK Jr. confirmation, Trump's plan to take over Gaza, maybe a reader question about the state of freedom in America, and so much more. But before we begin, let's hear from a sponsor. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners, Peter Suderman here. Are you a student looking for a transformative opportunity that supports the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students aged 16 to 24 to the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students sharpen critical thinking skills in small dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. Outside the classroom, they'll explore Chicago's vibrant culture, touring museums, trying improv comedy, and building lifelong connections. Parents, this program equips students to think, reason, and act independently. Go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Early registration is just $400 before March 1st, including room and board, with scholarships available. Don't miss out. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. Okay, in Washington this week, it is DOGE versus the deep state. Over the past week, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency has gained access to Treasury Department payment systems and data, sent staffers into numerous federal agencies, and been hit with multiple rulings from federal judges saying that DOGE can't do some of the things that it's doing, or at least not yet. Elon Musk loves to say, you can just do things. Well, in government, it turns out sometimes you can't. And the question is that a good thing? That's what we're going to discuss today. Christian, I want to start with you. Just give us an overview of what's going on here. There is so much news, so much happening, so many different staffers going into so many different agencies and so many different judges saying, hey, wait a minute. Walk us through what is happening and how we should understand it.
Sure. So at the top line level, I would kind of describe DOGE at the moment as kind of like the Captain Phillips meme where Elon Musk is saying, I'm the IT department now in the entire federal government. So what DOGE is doing is it's trying to establish the administration's kind of centralized control over government payment and personnel systems with the goal of eliminating positions and spending that conflict with Trump's various kind of political objectives, and then as well, this promise of rooting out fraud, waste, abuse, overpayments, what have you. So that's involved.
And there's a lot of that in government, right?
It's a big debate. I guess we're going to find out how much exactly. But, you know, with a multi-trillion dollar budget, there's surely going to be a few pennies that we could probably save. So that's involved, you know, these special government employees under the, you know, newly formed Department of Government Efficiency getting access to these Treasury payment systems. It's involved the administration saying it's going to convert chief information officers, so kind of like the top IT department official or IT officials at government agencies, into general employees as opposed to career civil servants where they deem that's appropriate. We've already seen some impacts from this. Grants that were supposed to go out under the Inflation Reduction Act aren't being paid. They've been paused. Various, you know, DEI classified employees at the Department of Education and elsewhere have been told not to show up to work. Most dramatically, we've seen this shuttering, I guess, of a USAID and it being brought under the aegis of the State Department.
Although that is one of the actions that has been put on pause, at least theoretically, by a ruling from a judge just this weekend saying that had to pause at least.
Right.
Not saying definitely can't do it, but that it has to pause for now.
Right. And so there's a lot of activity on both these fronts over the weekend. So on the one hand, you had Elon Musk saying, we're basically want to have the government have more up-to-date spreadsheets listing why every payment is going out with a little memo explaining what the purpose of this payment is. And, you know, we will probably use this in the future to stop payments and build out a list of individuals and organizations that shouldn't be receiving these payments. But as you mentioned, there's been legal challenges, and already judges have started to put restrictions on what DOGE and political appointees within the Trump administration are able to do. Most recently on Saturday, a judge in the Southern District of New York blocked these special government employees from and other Trump administration officials from accessing the Treasury's payment system on the grounds that they don't have the necessary security clearances and background checks, and that as a result, this opens up sensitive personal information of the people who are receiving government funds. That makes it more vulnerable to hacks. And so this sets up what I'm sure will be a pretty explosive legal challenge between just how much control does President Trump have over this massive federal bureaucracy that he oversees.
Catherine, it seems like there has been a shift in vision for DOGE. I mean, it hasn't existed for very long, but when it started, Elon Musk said the goal was to cut $2 trillion out of the federal budget. Now he says it will probably be much less than that. And part of the shift seems to have come from when Vivek Ramaswamy, who was originally the co-chair of DOGE, left DOGE, right? And Vivek had a much more traditional limited government view of what DOGE was going to do. It was going to slash spending and regulations. But Elon's approach, as Christian outlined, seems something different. Like, maybe it's like more like a government software upgrade. Do you think that is a fair characterization? And how do you understand, like, is that a good thing that Musk is like, hey, everything should be in order and we should have software that makes sense here?
Yeah, I would not have said a few weeks ago, gee, I really miss Vivek Ramaswamy, but here we are. And I do think that he was kind of the conscience of a legitimate initiative to cut government in a straightforward way of this project. I think Musk is, you know, he has made his name and made his fortune on making things more efficient and more energetic, if that's the right word. I mean, one thing that he said here is like, I'm going to work every weekend. And if all these federal workers go home every weekend, I'm going to have a 2-day advantage on everything as I try to shut stuff down. And we've seen that. That's been true, right? Like, even though we now know that he's like using weekends to shut down entire agencies, everyone goes home dutifully on Friday afternoon at 5 p.m. And then they come back and they're like, what do you mean I can't come in the front door? I think, you know, you could argue about whether or not that was a success at Twitter, firing a huge, huge, huge percentage of the workforce. And I think
Twitter still seems to work. I have seen Elon Musk tweeting memes from it as of like this morning.
Also this weekend, by the way, tweeting Reason stories, including our coverage of Javier Milei, who certainly would be on his mind at this time. So I think it does seem like the way Musk knows how to operate is, what if I kind of made things more efficient, thought creatively about how to do things differently, and just like brought a lot of zeal and a willingness to fail? And I do think Ramaswamy and some of the initial idea behind DOGE was much more about a kind of classic government cutting by eliminating programs entirely because those are not proper functions of government.
Okay.
And so I think there's two different things going on for sure, at least.
So there is some attempt to eliminate spending here, right? And some of these attempts are quite controversial in both large and small ways. The big ones have already become federal court cases. But then there's one small one that I want to ask you about, Matt Welch. Something that I have seen on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it now that has sparked a lot of outrage is the discovery that the federal government was spending something like the GDP of a small island nation on subscriptions to Politico. And first of all, is that correct? And second of all, can we cut enough Politico subscriptions to eliminate or even make like a real dent in the federal budget deficit?
I feel like that question needed to be asked in John Stossel voice if we're doing that. Are we really? Is it really $8 million, $1 billion, whatever? So that tells us a little bit about the kind of place that we're in, both politically and reformically, which is totally a word, which is to say, like, in a big picture, we are doing politics without journalism, which is the headline on a piece I wrote for the magazine a couple of issues back, which is to say the journalistic institutions have collapsed nothing really has replaced it. A lot of social media. And as part of that, we get it's almost impossible to write and trust the consumption of contextual media about this. So, oh my God, 8 million. That sounds like a lot. Sounds like they're subsidizing the whole left this way. And then people who are in the kind of information verification business will then counter like, well, no, it's a subscription to a premium product in Washington. There have been these things, newsletters mostly over the years, including and also like in the finance area, sort of Bloomberg terminals and Reuters terminals. They've been going for
or
a long time.
Interest Rate Observer. I mean,
yes, like, even like they're super expensive, although the trajectory of this category has been plummeting for a long time because of competition and technology. So Political Pro was at fighting kind of a rearguard action in this narrow little category. And so we had days and days and days of this. The same people who were telling me that interest in Ukraine 2 years ago was the current thing are now on like day eight of USAID gate, which is strikes me as a bit smaller beer than a sovereign country invading another one. But everyone's mileage may vary. USAID is for example, right? So this is where the money came into Politico subscriptions, and it was actually not very much at all coming from USAID. It was $8 million from the federal government from 2016 to 2025, as far as I know, or 2024. You can find this using available government databases. Without a contextual journalism background and with the journalism industries themselves screwing that up, everything is oppo research. And what Elon Musk is doing, in addition to going in and updating the software and saying, hey, look, you didn't fill out this field and you should, which he's right about, as far as I can tell, to the extent that I know anything about that technology. In addition to that, he is advertising this with every little thing that he can cherry pick, throw out there and have everyone lose their minds over in a 3 to 5 day debate about nothing. That doesn't really accomplish anything. So one of the questions that this moment is asking is, can you do reform without smashing stuff and lying? It's possible that the answer is no. One comp that we've been talking about on the recent site, Joe Lancaster had a piece, was comparing what Musk is doing right now, the Department of Government Efficiency, to Al Gore's Reinventing Government from 1993 to 1998, which, depending on who you talk to, slashed around 400,000 federal jobs, saved inflation adjusted about $200 billion. But that also came after a period of political competition in which kind of the Democrats tried to do a big government thing and lost. Newt Gingrich came in with all these big ideas, the Republican Revolution of 1994. Clinton triangulated and adapted it. And so there was an atmosphere post-conflict where you could do a bipartisan, very public, hey, we're doing this thing like we're trying to close down, Navy bases after the end of the Cold War. You were able to get things done like that. Question is, why did that stop being able to be done? Starting 24 or so years ago, there's a lot of answers to that. Maybe one of them is that the bureaucracies become so entrenched that there is no possibility to do that. I would say another reason, and sorry for talking too long, but you asked me a question, so it's your fault, is that none of the political parties are campaigning on this. Catherine mentioned Javier Milei. Milei campaigned on Afuera, and he was combative, yes, but he did it in a way where it was a completely articulated vision of what he was trying to do. Donald Trump didn't necessarily campaign on all the stuff that's happening suddenly right now. And so you have Afuera guy out there ripping Band-Aids off in this atmosphere of charged political conflict, which is going to kick up a storm. And you're just using the executive branch right now to say, I got the battering ram. Let's see how much I can batter before the end. So I think it's an open question whether this can lead to anything like a large and sort of permanent change in the way the federal government is done, aside from putting accounting codes on expense forms.
What I am hearing in this podcast so far is all reason staffers strongly support carefully annotated expense reports. And I just want to get everybody on the record with that for next month's.
I'm just asking questions here myself. Christian, since Matt brought up USAID, right? So Politico Pro is a small target. It's $8 million at most, probably less than that, depending on sort of how you look at the numbers. But USAID is a much bigger target. And Trump seems to be trying to do everything he can to either shut down or effectively shut down USAID. And there are kind of two views of this agency. One is, you know what? It's does a lot of good stuff. PEPFAR in particular is a good program that saves lives. Even libertarians will sometimes say, hey, that's the one good program that the government runs actually effectively and is like, it provides value. On the other hand, if you are reading Elon Musk's X feed, if you are reading the Doge supporters on Twitter, you hear that USAID is corrupt. It's fraudulent. It is, as Matt kind of referenced, people are saying it is UBI for the progressive left and the activist class. How should libertarians understand this agency?
I think both are correct. The AIDS program that people mentioned is kind of like the gold standard of what they spend their money on. But at the same time, USAID has, you know, even before the Trump administration came into office, there was a scandal about them illegally paying for abortions. Something I wrote about last week was about how USAID had this, multi-year project to go out into the wild and collect viruses to predict where the next pandemic would happen and, you know, create countermeasures for it when it does break out. And, you know, where was a lot of this work happening in Wuhan, China. And so at a minimum, you know, that didn't necessarily accomplish its aims. There's some suggestion that maybe it contributed.
Or did it. Or did it.
Blowback.
Euphemism of the year. Yeah. Early contender.
Too soon.
I think that the libertarian position should be this agency shouldn't exist. We should shut it down. Whether it's legal, what Trump is doing right now, that's something the courts are going to end up deciding. And so we're facing a legal battle about that. But this thrust of, hey, this agency is, maybe it spends some money on good things, but it shouldn't exist and we should shut it down. That's a good impulse. And so I'm positive about Doge kind of wrecking things, and maybe the courts will put some outward bounds on that. But so far, so good.
So I am one of the libertarians who has defended PEPFAR on this very podcast. And one thing that I've been thinking about over the past week is it's a good program. Like, it does what it's supposed to do for a cost that is not insane for the results. On the other hand, there is a huge amount of charitable giving from very wealthy people who would be interested in spending money on a good program that works. And so it seems to me that PEPFAR is perhaps not a program that could be exactly replicated through, say, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but that could be run through private charity and that you could probably get similar results and similar dollar level investments if you did that privately. Catherine, since Christian brought it up, let's talk about some of the legal issues and in particular the big picture constitutional issues. There has been an awful lot of discussion in Washington about what's called impoundment. This is something that my dog is obviously afraid of, but I think they're talking about something else. What is impoundment and why does it matter?
First, I just want to say, I think PEPFAR is the PBS of USAID. Like, I just want to give you those alphabets to think about.
I just died of Washington, D.C. disease.
I'm so sorry. We now have Washington toxicity here in the podcast booth, and it's unfortunate. Now, I mean, it's a single thing that works that could be privately funded that, you know, PBS already is kind of privately funded and shouldn't be used as evidence that government programs are good. I think there is this thing that is happening and which I have become gradually more alarmed about, I would say. Which is the Trump administration increasingly pushing back against just the very, very basic checks and balances that should be keeping the executive in check. And so we have, you know, on the one side, we have sort of a rejection of this idea on a very fundamental level that if Congress says that money should be spent on something, legally speaking, money has to be spent on that thing until you get Congress to change its mind and say so in the form of a law. On the flip side, this weekend, we have J.D. Vance saying the executive is not bound by judges when it is acting within its kind of legitimate sphere, whatever that is. It is not true that, like, the only entity that can put any check on Donald Trump's behavior is the Supreme Court. The entire judiciary has say on how laws are implemented, how they are interpreted in light of the laws themselves, if not the Constitution. And I think that this way lies trouble, right? You simply don't want an executive that increasingly says, I am not bound either by Congress or by the courts in any way, shape, or form. That is not something that I would like to see. I am so sympathetic to the many, many, many would-be reformers. Some of them are dear friends who have concluded that reform is useless and it's time for revolution. I get it. I super get it. I feel it in my heart every day. But I do think there is a difference.
Yeah, how are we going to get anarchy without a revolution?
I think there's a difference between doing a revolution and doing a riot. And it's not exactly clear which thing this is yet, right? Like maybe everyone's just running around and screaming and then later we're going to have to clean up the mess. Or maybe a bold new thing is being born. And because of the folks who are trying to execute it at this moment and the way that they are doing it, I fear increasingly that the whole project will end up discredited.
Matt, I just want to drill a little bit further down on the USAID question, because what the Trump administration seems to be trying to do here is not technically shut down USAID like in the sort of old school, let's just get rid of the Department of Government, the Department of Education kind of sense, right? It's not like, let's get rid of the EPA. There will just be no more agency. Instead, they're putting a bunch of the staffers for USAID on leave. They're recalling them from overseas. They're cutting jobs, but there's still going to be a few hundred people who work there. They're covering up the sign, on the door at the offices here in Washington. And this has resulted in an argument about what the Trump administration can do with regards to executive branch agencies and other federal staffers. Like, the president is in charge of the executive branch, and USAID was initially created through an executive order. So is it weird that the president doesn't have the power to fire or put staffers on leave or even shut down an agency that was, at least in its original inception, created through executive power?
It is a bit weird, although its original inception is no more. It was authorized statutorily by Congress, and you can't just make that go away. Just like with the Department of Education, the stuff that the Department of Education does was authorized by Congress in the mid-1960s, and so you need the Congress to be involved with undoing the Department of Education as part of it. And those checks and balances have a purpose, which in addition to it being, oh, we got to make sure that the president can't do everything, it's also that when we decide to do this, when you get the votes for it, it becomes a hell of a lot more permanent and real. This is true of the deregulatory pushes, bipartisan in the 1970s and early 1980s. It's been true of a lot of things over time, including the aforementioned reinventing government stuff. So you can do it that way. The USAID is operated through the State Department. Marco Rubio is saying, I'm in charge of it. And he's right, actually. It reports to him. So it's an independent agency on one hand, yes, but it's one that's sort of administered through the State Department. I think what is happening is twofold, specifically to USAID. One is that it has long been seen as the instrument of, or part of the instrument of, soft power, sort of within the State Department and around it, and that it's got a kind of bureaucratic mind of its own that is, in foreign policy circles, there's always been this, sense that the State Department is way too kind of internationalist left wing as opposed to the kind of Department of Defense, which is more realistic and kind of conservative. And so I think part of what Trump is doing is recalibrating that and saying you can't just go forever in your own direction that you decide. This is going to reflect the administrative values. That makes sense to me. They're also at the same time, again, oftentimes with hyperbolic or unfactual tweets and then people cherry picking them and broadcasting out, they're trying to smash the left. They're trying to smash the funding chains of the left. They're doing, in a way, what Arnold Schwarzenegger tried to do in his first 12 months as governor. If you recall, after the special election of 2003, in the November of 2004, he went after the left's funding with all kinds of ballot initiatives that were aimed at kind of stopping public sector unions, which is a good thing to do. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is way more sensitive to public opinion than Donald Trump, which is why the two men hate each other, He lost narrowly on his suite of ballot initiatives that were basically designed to smash the funding and kind of back scratching of the left. And at that moment, he then just turned on a dime and retreated and went to being big government Arnold instead of Milton Friedman Arnold, which is sad. I think what the Trump and Musk are trying to do is to overstate the case, frankly, about how much like the institutional left is just like this is where they derive their power from. And so if we cut it off, that'll stop. I think the actual effect of it will be closer to the first thing that I was positing, which is that there's this sort of soft power left of even the Democratic Party, a modal voter that has been enshrined in USAID and allowed to do things like fund opposition newspapers all over the globe. Like, knock that off. Give the BBC money. Catherine mentioned PBS PEPFAR. We gave a BBC through USAID like a fund to help like government run. What the hell? Stop. It's the BBC. Let the Biebs do it. So I think some of this will be...
They're Europores. They don't have any money.
Some of this will definitely be useful, and there should be a calibration. However, if you're going to make the presidents have more political authority over all of the departments and agencies and make things, sort of break up the bureaucratic kind of world and make it more top-down presidential, then the president's going to have more power over the executive branch. And there are reasons to, especially at this time of an imperial presidency that just keeps getting more monarchical by the second, there are reasons to preemptively wince in anticipation of that, even while applauding some of the corrective measures.
Matt, Arnold Schwarzenegger hurt you so bad, didn't he?
I love Arnold. Arnold's one of my favorite Americans. He's great.
He just like shows up in our discussion semi-regularly. Like, remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of...
Well, this was an important thing. Arnold Schwarzenegger was the last guy before, I guess, Elon Musk or the Tea Party Republicans in their brief time, who was out there talking up the Milton Friedman and blowing up the boxes and doing all these things. And it sounded really great. And it was really great. And it was an important corrective to Democratic governance gone awry. And it failed. And it is a disappointment. And California is not better off as a result. And nor are, I think, federal American politics.
Matt, I think you raise a really good point when you say that the thing that people are underrating here is that you need votes to cut spending in a big way. So if you go back to the original the debate about impoundment from the 1970s, which gave us the 1974 Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act. So that act was a response to Richard Nixon deciding not to spend money on environmental programs, mostly because he felt that those programs did not fit with his political program or his political goals. Congress was like, no, you can't do that. That is not in the constitutional design, because only Congress has the power of the purse. So they passed the Impoundment Control Act. But what people forget about the Impoundment Control Act is that it doesn't just reassert Congress's constitutional power over the purse and overspending. It also gives the president a mechanism to not spend money if the president doesn't want to do that. And that mechanism is rescission. And so what the president just has to do is say, hey, Congress, we don't want to spend that money. And you kind of send it back and you get them to sign off on it. And this is a Republican Congress that loves Donald Trump. And so it is possible, like I think, that Donald Trump could just say, hey, Congress, we're not going to spend this money. Give us the sign off. I am very skeptical of the idea that Congress would refuse to do so, that they don't have the votes in the current Congress. And so there is a mechanism by which to do impoundment legally and constitutionally and preserve the separation of powers, but we are not seeing it employed yet. And that, I think, brings us to the big question that I want to ask everybody here about how we think about all of this as libertarians, because it seems like the real divide is between the proceduralist approach, where everything is fully authorized and it runs through the proper committees and channels. Maybe it takes a little while longer, but, you know, it's legally solid. And then there is the Silicon Valley approach, which is move fast and break things. You can just do things, right? But like I said, sometimes in government, you can't. And maybe there's good reasons for that. Maybe we don't want a system in which the president can just do things. So how, Catherine, do you think libertarians, those of us who favor limited government, but also the rule of law and good government, should resolve this tension?
So I was too pessimistic about Javier Milei. And I am taking that to heart as I look at what is happening with Doge right now. I thought, even though, as you say, he ran on this, even though there was in some sense more of a popular mandate for this than I think Trump has, I still worried both that his more conservative tendencies would win the day, and also that doing what he was doing, which was cutting, and eliminating regulations, would run into enough barriers, and many of them legally legitimate, that it would give the whole project a bad name and not work in the end. Experiment still ongoing for sure, but it kind of seems like it's working. It's working pretty well. And so I want to take that spirit into the answer to this question. I hope this works. Like, on a very deep level, I really would love for this to work in some way, shape, or form. I fear that 3 years from now, government spending will be more than it was before. I fear that there will be no movement on entitlement reform. I fear that our debt and deficit will be the same. And I fear that where we will be is exactly the same place we were at the end of the first Trump administration, which is that the main positive change has been the regulations that didn't happen. Just a general reluctance to overregulate was the best thing about the first Trump term. And I fear that what we end up with is something similar at the end of this term, except that every single person on the left is now hysterically traumatized by the idea of the executive working to cut departments and regulations. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong about this the way that I was wrong about Millay, and that actually, in the end of Trump's second term, there's no Department of Education or a shell of a one. But I don't know.
Christian, bloodless proceduralism versus following the Constitution. Versus not following the Constitution, but doing awesome stuff.
Right, sure. So to paraphrase a line from the late Justice Scalia, under the Constitution, the old one, cutting spending, doing anything in our constitutional order required Congress, and it requires consensus. I think what the Trump administration is saying now, and just being very explicit about it, is that no, Congress is ineffectual. It really doesn't play a role in setting policy much anymore. That's what the executive does. Congress doesn't want to do this itself. And there's also no ability to really establish any long-term consensus on anything. So we're just going to break as much as we can, push the limits of executive power, and see if it sticks. In a lot of ways, that's, you know, on particularly what he's trying to do with immigration, that's not good for libertarian policy goals. On the question of impoundment, you know, if he can get this impoundment act maybe declared unconstitutional and establish much stricter or much stronger presidential powers to not spend money, I've been trying to think of like how that could backfire for libertarians, having an executive that just says, I'm not going to spend money that Congress is giving me. And I've been failing to find really nightmare scenarios there. And so I'm much more on the side of just, yeah, keep being energetic about this. And I'm down on proceduralism at the moment, but maybe I will come to regret that view. I have mixed feelings about all this. So,
Matt, Catherine mentioned the left's hysteria about what Trump is doing. So I want you to answer this question just by reacting to a tweet from Bernie Sanders last week. Yes, we have a major constitutional crisis. Americans did not fight and die to protect democracy so that the richest man in the world could single-handedly dismantle agencies that protect workers, consumers, and children. Together, we can and will defeat Trump's authoritarianism. Is there a crisis of democracy? Is Trump an authoritarian?
There's definitely a crisis of accents. I don't know how to get out of it.
I'm going to work on that one. Churchill fusion there almost.
There will be a crisis of constitutionalism when we get to the point during the Trump 2.0 administration where egged on by the likes of J.D. Vance, both as vice president and, 3 years ago in interviews with Vanity Fair, the Trump administration says to the Supreme Court, all right, you got any soldiers to enforce that? If not, you know, screw you. That will be a crisis. The fact that there's a rich person mucking about who has 1,000 trillion conflicts of interest, but who is basically insinuating himself into the U.S. Digital Services, which was created by Barack Obama to make Obamacare website not work so horribly. We haven't yet seen that. The fact of Elon Musk being a billionaire, that's not a constitutional crisis. It's actually a political opportunity for the Bernie Sanderses of the world is that Elon Musk is not particularly popular. And he's going to probably become less popular over time, and not just among the left. Today, Sohrab Ahmari, the ever-changing conservative-ish person who writes for 1,000 publications, wrote a big piece talking about why, like, MAGA needs to divorce Elon Musk once and for all. Steve Bannon has been weighing one-man jihad with lots of different buttoned-up shirts against Elon Musk for a long time. There's a natural split in the MAGA coalition where Musk is seen as a stalking horse to the tech bros who are soft on immigration and stuff like that. If you personalize all of this under one person who is not very popular, and if that one person who is not very popular is picking all kinds of fights with everyone who's around him and making accusations against people that are sometimes true and oftentimes not, this is all being done within the executive branch on stuff that wasn't always exactly campaigned on, I think you're building in a recipe for a political solution to Bernie Sanders's problem, which makes me, as someone who is right about Javier Milei from the beginning, unlike Catherine, makes me a long-term kind of pessimistic about what Musk is attempting to do. I think there are things that that this effort will do that will seem to be popular among the public, and the people say, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, great. And there's other stuff that will not. And meanwhile, Trump is doing things like, oh, let's just have a 25% tariff on aluminum, which is going to hurt particularly Canada and Mexico and Brazil and Germany and like trading partners that we used to like. Tariffs are regulations too. And they're big and bad ones. And they're also opportunities for corruption. So there's good reason to suspect that there's going to be negative impacts from Trump policies that are going to be looking for a scapegoat. So we might get a constitutional crisis. Some people in Trump's orbit are absolutely agitating for one, and we should be totally concerned by that. And we should also be concerned with the fact that we knew this going in before the election, and people are like, yeah, it's fine. Let's just go ahead and do it. But also, there's as usual, a political solution in the pendulum swing of American politics.
If you want to read more about this potential, these two roads, this dramatic crossroads, if you will, in the Trump administration, you could read the cover story of Reason Magazine that will be coming out at the end of this week from Stephanie Slade about this very topic. It's pretty good.
It's a great story. So we're going to close out here. But I just think the best way to understand DOGE, both its strengths and its weaknesses, is actually to look at where it came from. And where it came from was the internet. First, it was a funny mispronunciation of the word dog on the old web series Homestar Runner. And then it became a meme featuring an adorable Shiba Inu. And then Elon Musk, in his infinite onlineness, took that Shiba Inu meme and transformed it. He re-memed it into a funny acronym, the Department of Government Efficiency. It was almost a joke, but now it's kind of a real federal department, or at least the renaming of a real federal department. And so this is what we have right now, is government cutting by meme. And it has all the strengths of a meme. It's kind of funny and it's weird and it allows for a wide variety of interpretations. And most of all, it's catchy, so people want to be part of it. There's a virality inherent to DOGE. But it also has all of the weaknesses of a meme, which is it's not really a specific plan for anything. And because it can mean so many things, it doesn't mean any one thing in particular. And that is a problem when you're deep in the weeds of federal policy and procedure. And I think we are seeing both sides of that in how DOGE has been operating. It's funny and it's fun, and there's a kind of infectious energy to it. But that meme-like, that prismatic mutability also means it lacks focus and it struggles when interacting with complex bureaucratic systems. Okay, we are going to go to an advertisement right now. What impact will you make with your charitable giving this year? Giving can feel complicated. Lots of receipts, juggling different organizations, and trying to keep all the details straight. Donors Trust simplifies all that. With a donor-advised fund from Donors Trust, you can streamline your giving and even maximize your tax savings. Unlike some donor-advised funds that don't respect your libertarian principles, Donors Trust is proudly dedicated to advancing a free society, protecting your charitable intent, and championing individual liberty and free markets. And here's what's great. Donors Trust takes care of the details. It's private, secure, and managed by a team that shares your principles. You can focus on making a difference, not on managing paperwork. With Donors Trust, it's your vision, your values, and your impact. Discover a better way to give. Visit donorstrust.org/reason to get started today. That's donorstrust.org/reason. All right, let's move on to our listener question. This one comes from Eduardo. I've heard from Reason for a long time that we are in one of the best periods of human history in terms of freedom and economic prosperity. On the global scale, I believe this to be true. However, per Cato Institute's Human Freedom Index, as Americans, I believe we do have reasons to be pessimistic, not optimistic, about our future. As of 22, we are worse in all categories tracked by the Freedom Index, comparing our standings to the turn of the century. What reasons, if any, do we have to be optimistic about freedom's future in the U.S.? Or should we read the writing on the wall and start packing our bags for Argentina? Catherine, are we about to take a staff retreat to Argentina?
I mean, now that you mention it, that sounds pretty awesome. But I spent the weekend at LibertyCon, which is the annual conference of Students for Liberty, where I am a board member and I'm a longtime supporter. And every year really reminds me of the kind of global situation for liberty and how lucky we are in the United States. The one thing that really highlights this is they do awards. They do an awards dinner. It's student groups all around the world, and they are all fighting for liberty in their own way in their own countries. It is often the case that it feels kind of ridiculous on some level for an American group or an American student to be nominated in any of these categories, because it'll be like this group of students on the border, you know, 10 miles from the border of Afghanistan, gathered together 15 women to read some of the great works of classical liberalism, a great threat to life and limb. And then it'll be like, these people had a conference at their college in America. And then it'll be like,
fighting for liberty.
This group, several members in Venezuela either have been threatened with arrest or actually arrested and are somewhere in a jail cell. We don't know where they are. Jesus Christ, pray for their souls. And this this contrast is very, very real. So, you know, I do think, like, I always want to kind of stand by a fairly kind of progressive in the deepest sense story about global liberty, because I think it is the most important, truest story maybe ever in human history. And I also think it's fair to be a little skeptical about what's going on in the U.S. and whether we're trending in the right direction. Mostly, I think, just keep in mind the people all around the world who are fighting for liberty, and everybody is fighting in their own way. And if we have to just kind of keep pushing back on whatever the hell the Department of Education is doing here, we should absolutely do it. But we still have it awfully, incredibly good.
Christian, how's America doing on the freedom front?
Yeah, it's okay.
Don't sound too enthusiastic.
There's two halves to kind of the libertarian perspective on history, if you will, which is government is bad and is going to generally keep getting worse. And the other one is that markets produce amazing new technological innovations and satisfy people's preferences in new and interesting ways every day. And both those things are happening at once. You know, the kind of pessimistic take on that is that the latter is not going to solve the former, right? Markets producing amazing new things is not going to all of a sudden make the government this great engine for freedom or shrink it miraculously. But on the flip side, it shows, I think, that even with a huge, massive regulatory state that spends a whole bunch of money, the one that we have now, things are still, you know, the private industry is still progressing amazingly. We have all these new technologies coming out. It almost feels like, you know, the 2020s almost feels like another industrial revolution in some ways. When you look at what's happening with AI, with, I don't know, self-driving cars, space technology, whatever you want to mention. So that's cause for optimism, even if policymaking is still this, depressing blood sport.
Matt, American freedom, are you for it?
Totally. I'm prepping for the 250th anniversary of the Revolutionary War and thereabouts, and just getting pumped and watching the Super Bowl, which we'll talk about later. There's a lot of like patriotism core, which I appreciated. We are in an era, both for the United States and the rest of the world, where freedom is backsliding and has been for around 20 years. Like measure, the Fraser Institute / Cato, the Heritage Foundation, World Index on Human Freedom or Economic Freedom, all other types of global indices, press freedom. It's been the last 10 to 20 years. It's kind of like real estate in California, Catherine, to bring it back to Arnold Schwarzenegger, from 1940 to 1989, it went up always, and then it stopped. And kind of like freedom and economic prosperity and political liberalization from, let's say, 1948, the true end of the World War II era, to around the early 2000s, was like the greatest story ever told. So many people getting out of extreme poverty and countries being moved off the table from authoritarian to free. It was amazing. That's stopped. The order, the arrangements that helped midwife those things have been in retreat and desiccation, and they're being overthrown now by populism on all sides of the globe and all sides of the political spectrum everywhere you go. We don't know what it's going to replace it. It's likely going to be much more mercantilist, as we've seen already, less trust, more zero-sum thinking. Don't move to Argentina unless you're young. If you're young, you should move anywhere, whatever. Just go. You're young. Stop being lazy. But America's going to be awesome. We are marvelously self-correcting. We are gloriously stupid and smart, and it's fantastic. So don't bet against us. We still, in the last like 10 years, outpaced the growth of basically every single rich country in the world. Why? Because we're America. At the same time, we're backsliding. The world is backsliding. And long term, it's a great reason to be pessimistic about everything. The end.
Yeah, I guess I would want to say probably the best time to move to Argentina was before Milei started to crack down on inflation, because then your dollar would have gone a lot farther, right? So,
ooh, true.
Yeah. Wow.
We are gloriously stupid and smart, and it's fantastic. Could be the tagline for this podcast. just a reminder, we love to answer your questions. To submit yours, send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. Okay, now it's time for our lightning round. One of the problems with covering the news in the second Trump term is that there is just too dang much of it. So from my perch on Mount Moderation, I'm going to play Zeus and zap each one of you with a question like Dylan at Newport in 65. It's going to be electric. Catherine, let's start with you.
This is an unsafe work environment for me.
Trump says he wants the United States to take over Gaza. Speaking of unsafe environments, he says he wants to develop it, and he wouldn't rule out using American troops to do whatever it is he thinks he's going to do. How does that strike you?
I hate that you just did "how does that strike you" for your lightning bolt question. I hate that so much. Okay, so here's actually the thought that I had when I heard this quote from Trump is it briefly took me into a parallel universe where Donald Trump is just still a real estate developer. Like, none of this has happened, and he just has increasingly grandiose real estate development dreams, and he is now at the point where he is ready to redevelop Gaza. And that world is a better world. Like, the world where Elon Musk is just out here, like, building rockets, and Donald Trump is just trying to build luxury hotels in the Gaza Strip. Like, that's the world I want to live in. So,
on land that he owns legally and
right.
has acquired through a property rights system by paying the actual owners, we should be clear,
the
right?
The deal in this world, I think, is still a kind of crappy, shady deal where Donald Trump will renege on part of his agreements or whatever, but it doesn't involve the U.S. military, and that seems good. That's the world I want to see. The world that we are in right now where Trump says stuff like that and everyone goes, ah! Runs around screaming is not ideal, and that is not helping with what's going on in that part of the world.
You are right to focus on the development aspect and the way that Trump seems to think about this like a real estate developer. I have thought recently about the meme that almost certainly everybody has seen. You know, there's the guy who's only seen one movie, and it's Boss Baby, and he sees a second movie and it gives him real Boss Baby vibes. Well, Donald Trump is the guy who's only seen Boss Baby except for real estate. He sees absolutely everything through the lens of real estate development. That is the boss baby of his life. And so anytime he encounters anything else, he's like, this has given me real boss baby, real estate development vibes. And so that explains an awful lot of what he has said about Gaza. Christian, I want to ask you about something totally different. There were hearings last week, and it looks like Robert F. Kennedy will be confirmed to run Trump's Department of Health and Human Services. Is it time, finally, to make America healthy again?
Yeah. The way I like to think about this is it could be crazy good or it could be crazy bad, but it'll definitely be crazy. RFK has a lot of strange and unusual views. Some of those get at some serious problems we have with this giant bureaucracy, which is HHS, which is kind of all the horrible things about government rolled into one: inefficient research, you know, crony relationships with pharmacy and, you know, healthcare industry, and then also massive unsustainable entitlements. It's ripe for disruption. I don't know if RFK Jr. is the guy to do it. I'm much more optimistic about some of the sub-HHS nominees, you know, Jay Bhattacharya, the FDA nominee, Markey. You know, TBD, I guess, is what we'll say. But again, cautiously optimistic there. So,
Matt Iglesias, the Substacker, sometimes talks about the crank realignment and the way that America's cranks have moved from left to right. And I think RFK is probably the biggest and clearest sign of that.
Matt, I'm mad that you didn't transition to Christian by saying, Christian, you hate seed oils.
Wait, Christian, are you
Seed oil skeptic, right?
Optimistic about seed oils.
No, not cautiously optimistic about seed oils. Yeah, you know, that's one thing I would say about RFK is he has all these ideas about how it's red dye and seed oils that are making America fat and giving us chronic diseases, and that's not true. I mean, why are Americans fat is because calories are free and you can buy a machine that'll drive you everywhere and you don't have to move, right? So I don't think he's going to solve that problem, but some of these other more niche regulatory issues, the people who work for him might. So.
So, Matt, last week we talked about Donald Trump in his personal capacity suing CBS for an interview with Kamala Harris that aired right before the election. Last week, the network released the full transcript, which produced the following headline from the great Jacob Sullum: Trump is flat out lying about the 60 Minutes interview with Harris. And the subhead to that piece was the full transcript shows the president's complaints about the editing of the interview are not just wildly hyperbolic and legally groundless. They are demonstrably false. We also ran a piece about Brendan Carr, and who is Trump's pick to run the FCC, and all the stuff he is doing there, going after big tech platforms and media organizations. Just in general, how are you feeling about the prospects for free speech in the second Trump term?
I feel great because on his first day, he signed an executive order protecting free speech. So
that's right.
Instructing federal employees not to act in a censorious manner. So as long as he continues to fulfill the letter of his executive order, we should be in the clear. This shows how skin deep and tribal people are on free speech wars, generally speaking, and the MAGA coalition very, very specifically. And that's a great disappointment because they were right about rebelling against Joe Biden's horribly censorious regime, particularly around COVID. Brendan Carr is a menace. The FCC should be disbanded generally, but Brendan Carr I have special ire for because I know there's libertarians around that mofo, and he is instead choosing to be an instrument of government state power. He is using the FCC to actually care about withered things like the Fairness Doctrine. He's mad about Saturday Night Live. In this case, he really kind of compelled the transcript from 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes botched this from the beginning to the end, and will botch it later if they settle this lawsuit with Donald Trump, which they absolutely should not because it's meritless and it's a $10 billion lawsuit against 60 Minutes, which is insane, and its parent company.
That's a lot more. That's like a lot of Politico subscriptions.
So many. A lot of BBC support there. 60 Minutes, Kamala Harris gave two word salad sentences in a row that were semi-related to one another, but not really, in answer to a question from Israel. 60
We've
Minutes
all been there.
Botched it by putting sentence one in one clip and sentence two in the broadcast. Donald Trump then botched it by saying this was election interference, which election interference is this great word that if you are consistent over time, you find yourself arguing against 98% of people in American politics because they use it so promiscuously to talk about anything that they don't like. It's not election interference. It's editing of a television show. The first sentence, as the Wall Street Journal editorial board rightly put it, the first sentence was word salady and newsworthy. The second one was a little bit more on point, also newsworthy for a separate reason. They could have, the day after this became controversial, did what they did only under compulsion from Brendan Carr, which just release it and then, you know, take a round of criticism and then let's be on with our lives. None of that happened. Brendan Carr is volunteering to be the weaponized force to enforce Donald Trump's cranky upset at the way media handles itself, whether it's about ICE raids in San Francisco or Saturday Night Live guests in the Faraday Doctrine or the 60 Minutes things. It's shameful. He and Trump and MAGA are undoing two or three generations worth of actually good and principled conservative and Republican and libertarian media policy reform. They're just saying, ah, screw it. And this is a sign of the bad place that we're in politically right now.
All right. So speaking of moving on with our lives and television shows, let's go to our final segment, Cultural Recommendations, in which each one of our panelists brings something that they have been watching, reading, or otherwise consuming, tells us about it, and maybe whether we should watch, read, or otherwise consume it ourselves. Catherine, let's start with you.
Yes. Many times on this podcast, I have referenced my favorite podcast, which isn't this one, but instead,
wow, traitor.
Podcast 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. This podcast is back with a new season, I guess. It's called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, colon, the 2000s. And it's just really as good as the original. It's fantastic. And the reason you should listen to this is if you have any nostalgia connection to the music of the relevant period. And also, if you like hardcore history, which I know that Christian Brischke is a major, major fan of, and which I've also recommended on this podcast, or if you like Matt Welsh, this podcast is kind of like if Matt Welsh did hardcore history, but for music from the 90s and now the 2000s. It has such huge Welshian energy in the most delightful possible way. I cannot recommend it enough. If you're going to go straight to 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, colon, the 2000s, I recommend perhaps that you start with the episode on Complicated by Avril Lavigne.
Oh.
Yep. Yes. See? Did you hear that little grumbly sound that Matt made? Yep. That's how that podcast feels. It's good.
That does sound complicated. Christian, what do you got?
Yeah, sure. So I read a book that was kind of exploring, like, you know, one possible solution to what people talk about of like the male loneliness epidemic. And it's called A Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. So this is, to give a, you know, an elevator pitch for the plot, it's about a group of cowboys raping and pillaging their way across Mexico in the American West. The kind of question explored in the book is civilization just like this fig leaf on, you know, man's truly just violent nature and everything else is kind of a lie and inauthentic. And the book almost leaves you with that impression. And then right at the very end, there's like a paragraph long epilogue that's like, oh, no, actually, civilization has progressed and we're in a better place now. So,
hey, there's hope.
Yeah.
And they're not just raping and pillaging their way across the West. They're doing so at the behest of the government, thanks to a bounty system that has been set up, if I recall correctly.
Yes, right. So is that government cronyism or is this a critique of, you know, privatization? That's another real question. So
it's bad. Matt Welsh. Matt Welsh. I heard there was a major cultural event on television that people like pointed their eyeballs at over the weekend.
Because I'm an American, I know the answer to that trivia question. It is the Super Bowl, and I thoroughly enjoyed a really terrible sporting contest between the Philadelphia Eagles, who thumped the Kansas City Chiefs. But it's the spectacle that was more interesting, as usual, but definitely very much so in this case because the game itself wasn't that great. A lot of America Core, lot of good Brad Pitt speeches about the huddle as a metaphor for America. Yeah, sure. Okay. He's like all in the great building in LA. You had commercials were not as awesome as we would hope. The best commercial, and I recommend go checking it out, was Jesus. Jesus had the best commercial in this. Catherine,
like
was
our Lord and Savior Jesus?
Yes, sir. Catherine was talking about her her own personal deity. This commercial had Johnny Cash's posthumous version of My Own Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode as the soundtrack of a lot of people helping people through pain. And it was really moving and great because it's Johnny Cash and this is America. This is not Argentina. This is how we do it here in this country. It was very interesting to see kind of the vibe shift. I would say that the clear didn't get the memo on the vibe shift came from Nike, who had a couple of ads talking about like we need girls flag football and you know, because Chad is a bad guy kind of thing. That I don't think is responding necessarily to the zeitgeist at the moment. Kendrick Lamar's halftime performance was divisive among people. It was incredible bravura. He's an incredibly talented guy, and he did the Drake thing. And Serena Williams crip walked on Drake's grave, which is pretty great. But also it was just visually kind of stunning and beautiful. Super Bowl America, I recommend both. Also Jesus.
That sounds like a pretty good recommendation. I am not going to be recommending America because I watched the Oscar-nominated movie I'm Still Here, which is about the 1970s military dictatorship in Brazil, and in particular about Congressman Rubens Paiva, who was disappeared by the dictators and eventually tortured and killed. And the movie is about the impact this had on his family. And so part of the point is of the movie is that the dictators grabbed power by ignoring the usual procedures and paperwork. And a surprising amount of the drama in this film comes from his wife and his lawyer simply trying to get the government to admit that he was arrested at all. And the culmination of all of this isn't, well, we toppled the government or anything like that, although yes, it did eventually, the dictators did eventually go away, there was a new constitution. Now, the climax is just that after that happened, years later, his wife is able to go to a government office and get a death certificate, a record that just says, officially and formally, this happened and we are now following the procedures to acknowledge it. And it is a kind of quiet and powerful and incredibly well-acted film about living under an abusive totalitarian state. It's not playing in very many theaters, though I think it's going to be out in streaming in a couple of months. But you can find a showing. It is worth your time. Okay, that's our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can give us support to this podcast, as well as the great work at the rest of the Reason Foundation, by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Like James Bond, the Reason Roundtable will return.